China de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga vivos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundacion Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
He thought he was the smartest guy around. Well, I found out last Monday.
And coming up next on the Huff Net, or I should say on the Freak Radio Net at freakradio.org, it's the March 10th edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, which is also archived on the Huff website. We're kind of zeroing in on People's Park in Berkeley and the latest machinations of the Berkeley City Council. There's a lot there, and we'll probably split it up with some other stuff, too. But if you tag along, we'll all get to hear it.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Social significance, all other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So to kind of kick this off, I just got back from my Thursday Huff meeting, which was very tumultuous, and it did come up with some unusual results, or should we say not typical Huff results, though they were a standard for us years ago. We decided to do some tabling against we call it the vigil against two wars. One is the war on the poor here and the war on the people of Ukraine, and creating a lot of poor and homeless people there, big time. It took a lot of strong feelings in some Huff members. Even broke up the meeting for a while. And we did decide to do some tabling around that issue on Tuesday, the 15th, in front of it's O'Neill's, across from the old Cinema 9, which is now still showing movies, but they call themselves something else. And we're going to start at noon, and our issues are going to be end the war against the poor in Santa Cruz, which is best exemplified by the OVO ordinance, the oversized vehicle ordinance that was given approval in a somewhat modified form by the Planning Commission last Thursday, and also the CSSO, the Community Services and Standards Ordinance, which is really the sort of the sterilized way or the sanitized way of creating a new camping ban while pretending that you're being all legal about it, given the Martin versus Boise constitutional decision, which said you can't give people camping tickets or tickets for outside activities that are life-sustaining. That's actually kind of a crib from something that happened in Miami, the Pottinger decision of 20 years ago, but it's the same sort of thing, unless you have a place, an alternative for them to go. And so far, activists in Santa Cruz and their legal confreres, their legal consuers, their legal friends who have some legal skills have not yet gotten it together to actually muster a challenge based upon the Martin versus Boise decision here, though they kind of reference it in the ACLU recently wrote a letter supporting their opposition to the OVO ordinance. I think they may have written something similar way back last summer when the CSSO ordinance, the new camping ban, was passed. But there hasn't been any actual attempt to get an injunction on that basis here, nor has there been clear defense of somebody's ticket based upon the Martin versus Boise constitutional finding by the appeals and upheld by the Supreme Court. And that may be partially because the legally nervous and you might call them even conservative in a way, although not interested in conserving the bad camping bans and the bad criminalization of the homeless, but at least conservative in their belief that they're not likely to break new ground. They have to be very careful about losing what ground they have. That's sometimes what at least some attorneys seem to be thinking, and I suspect that they're thinking that around these issues. Though, again, this is speculation on my part. And the use that I've heard of in the Santa Cruz courts of the Martin versus Boise case as an argument for throwing out a citation for being in a closed area after dark. And part of that also has to do with the loosening of the camping enforcement under the COVID so-called emergency. It's actually not just a so-called emergency. It's an emergency. I'm using this in the sense that it gives the city manager and his subordinates wide powers, as well as the equivalent county officials, to dictate laws without much public comment, dictate new policies. And they have been doing that. They really need to if they want to criminalize any particular homeless behavior, because the laws have been put in place in Santa Cruz and are really a very tight tripwire that the police and the deputies can enforce at any time. For instance, there is a no trespass at night zone all around the county building and the government buildings. You would think that the government buildings would be open to peaceful protest at night. Well, not since 2011 and the Occupy movement. And there was no damage done to any buildings at that time. They had no justification for doing it other than simply to create an excuse to eliminate the encampments there. Similarly, all parks, including San Lorenzo benchlands, everyone is there, in theory, in violation of the no camping at night, but no presence in the campground at night. The city council has never changed that law, so it's been completely in the hands of the city manager and the police chief, who's, I guess, Escalante at the moment. They haven't got a new police chief yet. A number of issues that I could get into, but as usual on Thursday, I'm under a time crunch, so I'm going to have to jump directly into some interviews in order to get this out in a timely fashion at 6 o'clock when I normally do this netcast, although it can be reviewed at any time later on the Huff archives at huffsantacruz.org. Just go to latest shows, and you can find that in other shows. So we're going to begin with Berkeley. Berkeley, as you're going to be hearing, has both had some victories and some setbacks. We'll be hearing what they, or at least Carol Denny, or Cornerstone Carol, the activist that I have regular communications with, and you may have heard before if you listen to this netcast regularly. She is as I've said before in introducing her, she's a writer, she's a singer, and so forth, and she puts out regular publication, which you can find on the Berkeley Daily Planet website, called the Pepper Spray Times, which of course is a satirical comment on the abusive use of pepper spray by the Berkeley Police Department, and in essence the kind of here's the latest absurdities that the Berkeley police and their allies and their business friends and their sellout supporters on city council are doing. It's every month it's available to look at on the Berkeley Daily Planet. You can actually get a hard copy of it if you're up there. I'm not quite sure where. I get it in the mail, and you can also get it by going to Carol Denny's website. But let's begin by listening to her latest thoughts on the struggle to maintain People's Park, which is under threat from the University of California, which owns the property, which wants to build a 12-story building there. They call it housing, somewhat similar, I think, to the bait-and-switch approach used by In my view, the Santa Cruz right-wing majority on city council for doing the library burial shtick that they're trying to do by adding housing to it as a kind of teaser for people. Anyway, I'll begin. A lot of this interview is self-explanatory, but listen in and catch more details from Carol and the occasional question from me.
I'm with Carol Denny, Cornerstone Carol, of course. She's, that's what I call her. She's in Berkeley, and she writes a regular column, a regular publication, the Pepper Spray Times, as well as many a song, and I don't know, what else are you up to, Carol?
I just got back from traveling in West Virginia, playing a lot of music, and I have to say, I interviewed a lot of people about People's Park, and they all are stunned as apparently the Los Angeles Times editorial board is, that the UC Regents have set their sights on building 12 stories of housing in the middle of a beautiful park. So it was fun to come back and see not just that editorial, but see that the courts refused to cave in to the Regents, who had asked that they be able to continue over-enrolling new students in at UC Berkeley to the point where we have UC students, like everybody else, sleeping in their cars, sleeping under overpasses, you know, living in one-bedroom apartments with essentially hot cots, six people to the same bed. And, you know, this is something that the Regents built along the way by buying up low-income housing and replacing it with high-end student-only housing that you have to lease. So you have to commit to a very expensive lease. And if your plans change or if COVID hits and you've got to take care of your kids or your plans change, you're just stuck with a lease. It's a very landlord-friendly operation up there, and it's all about money. So I'm kind of enjoying the court victory where Judge Seligman of the Superior Court of Oakland said, nah, you've got to stick to the, I guess it's the enrollment levels of several years ago, I think 2 years ago or something, 2020, I think it was. So, in other words, they can't just keep enrolling and enrolling more students who are, of course, paying exorbitant rates for a university education that used to be free before Ronald Reagan was governor. And they're very angry about it. And so the sad song they're playing in the press right now, you've probably, many of you who still glance at the newspaper now and then, we're seeing Dan Mogiloff, UC spokesperson, at his best, saying, like, oh, these poor students are being deprived of an education. Whereas my friends are all joking that these poor UC students are being deprived of, you know, the benefits of sleeping in the gutters of Berkeley. Because that's kind of how it is. I mean, you can usually still get, you know, a handout or a good meal in People's Park from Food Not Bombs, but having to sleep in the gutter is really an experience, perhaps an education, but not the education they were expecting.
So how likely is this court ruling to stand?
Pretty good. Pretty good because what they have done to the California Environmental Quality Act is trim it, prune it, but they have not been able to destroy it. And even if, I think it's Leno, there's a bevy of politicians who are so developer-friendly that what they'd like to do, one of the rumored things they want to do, is take all UC student housing or UC projects and exempt them from CEQA. The thing is, that wouldn't apply to the projects that are already in their pipeline, so our CEQA challenges would be unaffected. But they're also, what they're up against is the simple fact that whatever they're inventing in the world, it's not real estate. So we have a finite amount of actual square footage in a relatively small town, and it's about as dense as it can get. At the point at which they're proposing 17 stories of high-end luxury student-only housing on People's Park, which is our most famous landmark and a city landmark which has just been accepted for the federal register, the national register, rather. So it will be a federal landmark in no time at all. And I'm really proud to say that I was one of the handful of activists who got together about 2.5 years ago and decided that that was our best course. It isn't like we don't know that at some point, you know, what the chancellor of UC Berkeley loves to do best is fill the streets full of police and beat our heads in. It's just that we thought maybe there was a more creative approach and that we would achieve federal landmark status for People's Park in the hopes that what is, in fact, one of the most significant cultural landmarks that we have nationally is recognized as such. And the California Historic Resources Commission agreed with us this past October 2021 and unanimously affirmed its eligibility for national landmark status, at which point it's just kind of a shoe-in. They adjust the dot I's and cross T's, but no one at the federal level objects to a state's own unanimous recommendation for national register status.
Now, what would be the significance, Carol, of that landmark status? Would it actually be a bar to creating this multi-story structure or not?
Not necessarily. On the other hand, it increases the embarrassment factor. Mm. They're pretty embarrassed right now that Judge Seligman just gave them the boot out of court, asking, because what Seligman had said was, look, you're paying no attention to CEQA, your CEQA is inadequate. In other words, their environmental quality impact statement just said, well, basically, move over and make room for another 20,000 students, whether we have beds for them or not. And it's here in the city of Berkeley, and certainly in Oakland, and certainly in El Cerrito, the Bay Area and San Francisco as well, has been hit with a housing crisis that I don't have to explain to you. Everybody out there knows, you know, it used to be two or three people, you know, sleeping in a park or something, people down and out, and it was easy to help that many people. Now you have thousands of people sleeping in their cars, sleeping under overpasses, sleeping in our parks, sleeping in the hills. Thousands. And it was done decade after decade and development after development, replacing low-income housing, often rent-controlled low-income housing, like 1921 Walnut. They just knocked that down 2 months ago, destroying everything. That was a Ratliff building, which was not just a landmark building. It was a landmark building built by the city of Berkeley's only city architect in the 1920s. It was a thing of beauty, and they just smashed it up. And one of the things I used to do, I worked on a construction crew, and we did demolition for reclamation. We would knock buildings down, but we would save all of the windows. We would save the beautiful wood. We would save the doorknobs. These are all things that are used by artists. They're used by contractors who want to at least give the, you know, hang on to the elements of a period building. These are valuable things. UC didn't save an inch of it, not even the glass. Beautiful arched windows, turrets. That was, of all things, Walter Ratliff had built a garage. It was a garage built in the 1920s, used by the University of California. But he built it with a nod towards Spanish, Moorish architecture, all of these odd elements that you find throughout Spain and in that part of the country, various Arabic countries, because he'd never seen anything like it. He thought it was wonderful, and so he incorporated these things. At UC Berkeley, only about 5 years ago, when it was first pitching the idea of taking that garage and the surrounding buildings and turning it into a UC building, kept the entire first floor, or it all is just ground floor warehouse and garage building. It just looks like something out of Harry Potter. They kept all that first floor because it actually suited the building itself to have a courtyard and welcome people into the courtyard and then build the housing over top of it. They didn't have to destroy it, and their own architects knew that. But that's what they just did. So, you know, there's a cumulative effect when you are this much of a bully and when the numbers just don't add up to anything except high-end housing, like most of the UC students, let alone the rest of us in town. We can't afford the kind of housing that they're building. So you're not exactly addressing the housing crisis when you build this kind of stuff.
Now, who benefits from this, aside from the developers and the builders? Are there other people who benefit?
Politicians.
Politicians?
The way it works is you get your permit if you put enough money into my reelection campaign. It's that simple.
I mean, are these buildings lying vacant, or are wealthier people moving into them?
Oh, no. That garage was used as a garage. I mean, it was since the 1920s. I mean, it's a 100-year-old building still being used as intended, and there's plenty of places for them to build high-end student housing if that's what they're dedicated to building. It's just that I think the L.A. Times, a very conservative publication, California's largest newspaper, the L.A. Times is not being fooled by any of this. All it's doing is exacerbating the housing crunch, and certainly having students, it isn't just that it's absurd to have students who are expected to live in their cars or invent housing out of thin air. It's also not the education that they got or that I got. I was a UC student. I mean, I went to UC Berkeley, and the classes are much bigger. The expense advance is extraordinary. These are students who are graduating with a debt that probably you and I can't even imagine. You know, it's unimaginable to me to imagine going to college and then exiting college with, oh man, even $30,000 of debt, but some of these students have over $100,000 of debt that they just have to somehow deal with. They have to, have to hope they get a really high-paying job. And I think it changes you when you see an education that way.
So when I was at People's Park today, I was hearing that there is a plan, or the rumor has it, there's a plan to begin demolition work and building this summer. Is that your understanding?
I don't know. I don't know what the timing is, but I can tell you one thing. UC tends to demolish and then, you know, just sort of look over its shoulder and say, whoops. So they're right. They're right.
Hmm. And I know in the past, you know, in fact, that was really when we first met, and when there was resistance by the neighbors and by user development folks and by activists of all sorts, when they were trying to put in sports courts back in the early 90s, that was it was successfully fought to some extent. And yet, when we've talked about this more recently, I think you've been somewhat more pessimistic about user developed resistance.
I was.
Maybe you weren't. Update me on this.
My assessment. The frank fact of it is that we were unable to stop the volleyball courts, but we were able to consistently protest the volleyball courts, and they eventually had to remove
right.
volleyball courts.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'd say that our resistance. Our persistence and our resistance was successful in restoring the park to what it was supposed to be, an expansive open space that, yes, you can use recreationally. You can still play volleyball there. You just can also use it for frisbee and picnics, and it's multi-use the way it is right now. The purpose of putting deep sand pit volleyball courts in People's Park was to make those sand pit volleyball courts useless unless you wanted to play a regulation game of sand pit volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to convert what was a community use park with a variety of purposes, including, of course, the stage, the concert stage, the quintessential public forum that it has been for anti-war activity, among many, many other things. And convert it into something that's just purely UC recreation.
And we'll be picking up on this in a moment, but now our standard musical break.
At the end of World War III, as people look for clean water to drink, as they're dreaming of the days when they had a kitchen sink, wishing they could try again to talk to belligerent men back when we were only hanging on the brink. At the end of World War III, when everyone has the same thought, is this what imperial intransigence wrought? Life under occupation, or the end of creation? Decisions that decades of lost opportunities brought. At the end of World War III, with billions dead or dying, it won't matter who was right, who was lying. When civilization has ended, once the last warheads descended, only then will there be no one left denying. At the end of World War III, as the few left alive survey the rubble remaining, wondering how long they'll survive. Too late to question the story of expansion or conquest or glory. No time to rewind from the date Armageddon arrived. At the end of World War III.
That was one of David Rovick's latest, called The End, or At the End of World War III.
Where you would feel out of place if you weren't playing volleyball. And in fact, I'm one of the many people who was thrown in jail for being in the sandpit volleyball courts and playing in a circle instead of in the regulation snake game you're supposed to play. You've got to have 18 players. They have to move up in a certain formation. There are certain rules. And they had a chief of police at the time, a guy from Jamaica who was a... He was a volleyball king, man. He really knew the rules, and he had been, he instructed the whole UC police force to arrest anyone who entered the volleyball courts but was not playing a regulation game. We got thrown in jail for making sandcastles. We got thrown in jail for putting an American flag on the net and then playing a regulation game of volleyball. We got thrown in jail for just anything that had the smell of protest, and we just kept going.
Did anyone ever recover any money for the false arrests involved in this?
Now and then. Yeah, now and then. We really wore out the lawyers we had, and it took years. So it was piddling money compared to the, over $2 million within 6 months of the existence of the volleyball courts was what UCPD and UC, therefore, and taxpayers, therefore, had to spend on a 24-hour police protection for the volleyball courts. That's how much they were hated. Hey, one time, one of my favorite protests was somebody bought a really old car. I mean, it was something recognizably 30 years old. And drove it somehow into the park and floored it, sending it sailing right through the fences that surrounded the sandpit volleyball court. And that thing flew probably 25 feet toward the center pole and fell in the sand. Whoever was driving it, whether it was one person or two, I have no clue. All I know is they got up, out, and they ran. And it took days for UC to try to figure out how to remove that big-ass old, it looked like a Cadillac, but I think it was something else, that huge old car from the sandpit volleyball course. And, of course, it was all smashed up. They tried to repair it. The thing is, it started to look funnier and funnier and funnier. And looking like a laughingstock just didn't suit them. they finally yanked it backwards.
Well, I guess my question, Carol, was there was resistance, and I was saying it was successful, certainly to an extent, back then. Is there a possibility for any kind of resistance now?
What? How can you ask me that? I've spent my whole life resisting this kind of...
I don't just mean you. I mean the community, everybody else.
I don't speak for the community. I speak for me.
I know.
And you just can't went up to people's parks, so it sounds to me like you're talking to people.
I talked to a couple. I just wondered if your sense of any organizations getting involved, that sort of thing.
All right. I do, in fact, work with and speak for the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group, and we just got the Los Angeles Editorial Board, not just to mention People's Park, but to mention the shortage of park space and the necessity of parks and open space in places with density. Don't tell me that we're not organizing when that happens. That, you know what that represents? That represents the sky falling on the UC Regents. That represents something. This is quite a day today. So, you know, if you're feeling depressed behind people not organizing, I'd say that you need to get out into the game, because, boy, is that happening.
No, I'm just asking, because I'm not in Berkeley much, and you are, so I thought you would know more than
that. It's a red-letter day for those of us who are organizing. Judge Seligman refused the UC Regents, who own the Oakland courts, what they asked for, which was to ignore his own court order. And they appealed it up to the California Supreme Court, and the California Supreme Court said, go fish. That's a red-letter day.
Here down in the center.
Not all of the protest has to happen in the streets. And I've been in the streets, and I've been hogtied and beaten by UCPD, and I won't even go into what BPD has done to me. But you can also organize in other ways, in creative ways. Tomorrow I'll be working with an international group of women who are doing poetry internationally from all over the world. A big, thank God I'm not organizing this, a Zoom meeting from a bunch of different time zones. So I just want to say, you know, because I hear you wanting... And many, especially men, seem to want this. What they want is for us to have some kind of people's army armed with the inadequate things that we're usually armed with. And what I'm saying is that, yeah, eventually there probably will be a street confrontation over this, because there always is. But until that day, there are untold things that we can do. And boy, is my group being successful at doing them. I want some credit here, because it isn't every day when the L.A. Times editorial board supports People's Park. Mm-hmm. Don't miss that editorial.
I'll take a look. I'm wondering, here in Santa Cruz, we have... we've been fighting the OVO law, which is the oversized vehicle ordinance, which is, I guess, something that, I don't know, I guess you've already passed something similar in Berkeley.
Oh, God, yes. I'm so embarrassed to say yes.
In Santa Barbara, by the way, one of your old stomping grounds also is fighting that, though, I think, legally, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's discriminatory. It should be fought. And, you know, I hope that... I mean, our legal department is all in for this shit here in Berkeley. It's very sad. And Santa Cruz, I don't have to tell you, very sad. So if we fight on, we just have to keep fighting.
Any sense of how the RV community is dealing with the situation?
I can tell you that in Berkeley there are really talented people who do blogs and do films and do songs and festivals and parades, RV parades, and have tried to keep the consciousness up. It has not impressed the Berkeley City Council, but it certainly is inspiring.
Mm-hmm. How's the? I know that the folks down at the 880 or whenever the main freeway were driven away.
Yeah, and fenced off. And if you walk, try to walk through there now, you can't. And if you drive through, you have huge fences on either side of this little corridor that's left when you go under that freeway.
Mm-hmm.
It is so sad. That's one thing our mayor here in Berkeley, Jesse Ottegien, has brought to town. Any place where there was once any kind of tent group collecting together for warmth, safety, and camaraderie is fenced off. So there's a fence around the post office. There was a fence on one side of City Hall because, yeah, they would chase a group of people with tents from one side to the other, and they finally fenced off that open space. So wherever has been, there have been places, except for here, there. Here, there is not only still here and there, they have an alliance with Friends of Adeline, which is a neighborhood and businesses working for a more sensible solution and cooperation between people on the street and people in the neighborhood, and they're still doing a good job. They're the ones who fought successfully for porta potties and trash pickup and so forth.
And this is an encampment on the border of Oakland and Berkeley, and
yes.
And it's for a time, I guess they had several other encampments in different places as well. I don't know.
Yeah, there are various groups that call themselves different names. So it's, you know, I hope somebody writes a book someday about all the different groups. They've usually been organized behind sets of principles, some of them with specific political aims, some of them just civil rights aims. And here, there really is a place to live where you can recharge your phone. They have solar panels. They have collaborative cooking and collaborative art events. I did an art event with Here, There that where we had a big gallery show. It was the most popular and most lucrative gallery show Expressions Gallery had ever had. Mm-hmm. It had the most coverage. It certainly had the best party, so it was great.
Hmm. Any news about Street Spirit?
I haven't seen Street Spirit in quite a while. Actually, I saw an issue about a couple of months ago that was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so my hat's off to Alistair Boone, who's keeping it going anyway and keeping it focused.
Mm-hmm.
And she also was doing a good job of counting the dead. We have lost so many people on the streets, and I was glad to see a lot of the friends who I've lost recognized in the issue that I saw.
How are street musicians treated in Berkeley these days?
Oh, street musicians are kicked around and treated like dirt.
There you go.
Yep.
Now, I just said there was a... How about street vendors?
Happening with street vendors, I think right now is a really hard time because of the COVID, because of the pandemic. And I did play for the Telegraph Street Fair, Holiday Street Fair, right around Christmas. They have a Holiday Street Fair up there that used to be a huge thing. And it was, you know, maybe between 10 and 25% of the vendors that are usually there. It was pretty thin. But there were, you know, some good artists there. And so I think it's very difficult right now.
I know that I haven't seen much, although I haven't only been, I've only been up, you know, like one or two days a month at all, if at all. Well, monthly. And seen much of, there used to be, you know, a lottery. People would get vending stalls on on Telegraph Avenue. Is that still happening?
People do vend on Telegraph Avenue regularly. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess I just miss it, or I look sparse whenever I'm up there. And of course, it is COVID days, so you
know. It is much more sparse, and so are the shops that are open. There's a lot of shuttered businesses. I noticed last time I looked at the website called Berkeley Side that calls itself a newspaper, I guess, they were doing like a death count of how many businesses bit the dust last month or something, and I thought, that's good. You might as well be real about it, that a lot of businesses are just folding because, well, I'm certainly someone who, I guess I used to go to the movies now and then, but I don't go to the movies. I mean, I really avoid anywhere where some jackass is going to expose me to something that'll kill me. Mm-hmm. So, really cuts down your options.
Well, also, you're pretty vulnerable yourself, right?
Why? Thank you. No, yeah.
No, I've heard, anyway.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, well. What about free radio or free radio Berkeley? Is there such a thing still happening there?
I think Berkeley Liberation is still going, but I don't know. You should look them up and find out what they're up to. Yeah.
Any sign of Stephen Dunifer in the area?
Oh, good heavens! I talk to him all the time.
All right.
Yeah, he'd be a good person for you to interview.
I should give him a call.
Yeah, just give him a call. He's around and doing lots of stuff. Still working with international groups.
Mm-hmm. If you happen to be in touch with him, because I think it's any number I have is probably long gone.
Would you like his new number?
Yeah, if you could you email it to me?
Why don't I just give it to you?
All right, let me stop the recording.
Okay.
You have a busy day ahead of you tomorrow, I hear.
I do.
So, you know, I could go on asking questions, although I'm beginning to falter myself.
Let's get some rest and talk again soon.
Okay, well, thank you for the update, and congrats on the L.A. Times victory.
Thanks.
I'm not a fan of the L.A. Times, but it's the biggest newspaper, as you say, so what are you going to do?
Well, what I'm saying is that when a conservative publication, the largest in California, says what it says in its editorial, it's not talking to you, and it's not talking to me. It's talking to the U.C. Regents, the most powerful development group in town. And that's a good day for us.
All right. Well, let's hope they listen. And if they don't, then others will talk louder, we hope.
We hope. All right. You have a good night.
Hey, thanks, Carol.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Blessings. Ashe. Salam. Peace to Sophia Bukhari.
Albert Nev Washington.
Herman Ferguson.
Richard Mafundi Lake.
Marilyn Buck.
Kouassi Balogun.
Phil Africa.
Melvin Dixon.
Delbert Africa.
Oscar Washington.
Iafulani Suni Ali.
Luis Rodriguez.
Afeni Shakur.
Hugo Pinnell.
Mondo Wilano.
Eddie Hatcher.
Herman Wallace.
Robert Webb.
Bashir Hameed.
Lolita LeBron.
Teddy Jahi.
Geronimo G. Jaga.
John Trudell. Fred Hampton.
Free them all.
From before this
place was a country dissenters have had to pay by getting hanged at the gallows or by getting locked away. Rise up against the empire. Try to break your chains or in any way challenge the power of those who hold the reins. Railroad people to prison with charges pinched from air till we meet your firing squads and your electric chairs. From before the FBI was formed to the surveillance state of now, you'll know it's the revolution. I'll tell you how when we free them all.
Jericho movement gon' free them all. Behind these walls, behind them walls, that Jericho movement gon' free them all. Justice, education, retribution, integrity. This coalition organized that has the recipe. Honoring all those who led before and after me. From the BTP to that AIM movement. That's the type of schooling that my pops is doing. Peace to all prisoners of dictator politics. We fight to abolish it, dedicated to stopping it. Free them all is the call. The movement's Jericho. Revolution not televised, but in stereo. I heard being woke is the first call to action. I've been doing that since before I knew fractions. Mr. President, on behalf of the residents, free Moon Mia and Leonard Peltier. Y'all been doing this for over 500 years. Free Bill Dunn and my Udo Oso Blanco in solidarity. Survive till I go.
Free them all. The walls of Jericho fall. Free them all. Between the two, Mumia.
Free them all. Free them all. Free them all. That Jericho movement gon' free them all. Behind these walls, behind them walls. That Jericho movement gon' free them all.
Track was called Free 'Em All, a song for political prisoners. It's a part of a bigger release. The three artists who sung it were, of course, David Rovix and Opium Saba, as well as Mick Crenshaw. And it's part of something that's going to be released in a larger album in a few days, maybe even tomorrow. And if you go online, look up David Rovix, and you'll find at least part of it, and possibly more of it. I think it's, of course, I think they may be doing it as a commercial release, but have to go find out, I guess. Carol Denny talking about People's Park. I was up there just sort of picking up some street spirits and street sheets from San Francisco. Two newspapers written, if not by homeless or unhoused folks, by people who are writing about them with some information, some access, and some sensitivity to what the politicians are scheming and planning for them. And also, their voices have some outlet there as well. If you want to get a copy of any of these papers, you can find it at Steve Plaich's Homeless Persons Legal Assistance Project, or you might be able to. We've left some copies off there. His office is at 703 Pacific, which is the UNHQ. And he's around. He's available from, I think it's 10 to 12:30 Monday through Friday, although I think the office may be open, and you may be able to, if there are papers available, to get a copy just by dropping by. In any case, I also stopped by People's Park while I was up in Berkeley picking up copies of the paper, which you can also find, by the way, online. Go to thestreetspirit.org, and you can read it without even, just spoiling the environment by supporting the paper version. But if you do support the paper version, presumably, hopefully, you'll be buying it from a homeless vendor. It's usually about $2. Or whatever you want to give them. And follows East Bay and San Francisco homeless stories. unfortunately, a lot more than Santa Cruz and other areas. We used to have a lot of stories in Street Spirit about a decade or more ago, but that day has kind of come and gone, although who knows, it may come again. If you want to be, if you're a writer and you want to be involved with writing about the Santa Cruz area or the Monterey area or the San Jose area or any other area, actually, that isn't covered currently, or even some that is, by Street Spirit. And again, look online if you have access to a computer or just pick up a copy. You could also find it at the Sub Rosa. That's the cafe that we hold our meetings at on Thursdays from 11 to 1, usually later, actually. And it's also, well, there's a really free market coming up on Sunday from, I guess it's 11 to 2:30. Maybe it's 10 to 2:30. Anyway, it's certainly around the noontime, and it's a lot of kinds of free stuff. Bring stuff you want to pass on to people, clothing, records, books, utensils, whatever you got, and, you know, clear out all that stuff that you don't want in your house but you think might be useful to somebody else and bring it to the Sub Rosa courtyard, and you can perhaps find something you yourself want to find Street Spirit, which is in a rack there. Grab a copy and give a couple bucks to a homeless person if you're not houseless yourself and you can afford it. You should also find a copy in the library. In fact, you can probably find back issues. We try to insist the library keep back issues. Sometimes they unaccountably disappear, maybe because somebody takes them or maybe because the library screws up. I don't know. We had to put a little pressure, I did, on them to make sure they stayed on the shelves and that they weren't sort of thrown into the discard pile, or at least something like that. I was afraid was happening. Maybe it was simply some other cause was causing the Street Spirits to disappear from the magazine shelves of the library, where you can now, as of at least a month ago, you were able to find them. That's the main public library in downtown Santa Cruz. Listen to a bit of discussion, interview, people talk from People's Park, the actual people who live there, who really should be listened to. The major problem with all the schemes and plans of bureaucrats and politicians everywhere is they don't pay any attention to really what homeless people want, and they don't involve them in the decision-making process. Although there's a little bit of a change in that, though not, unfortunately, at the place where the money meets the road. So the $14.5 million that's being given to or being grabbed by the Santa Cruz City poverty pimps, who are, they all met to with their hands out. Actually, it was more like the person who was organizing all this, the city manager, Matt Huffaker, actually, and Larry M. Wally is the homeless response manager, something like that. I'm not aware they had any kind of unhoused people on their team at all as to what would be the best way to connect homeless folks with what they need and to determine exactly what they need. As I've said before, the main purpose of the city, we'll be probably talking more about that on Sunday at the longer show, purpose seems to be to speed up and enable enforcement of the camping ban and of the OVO ordinance, as I mentioned earlier. But let's hear what the people at the People's Park have got to say. Here's a few of them.
Yeah, it's People's Park, Berkeley. About 10 after 2 on March 7th.
You know what I mean? Like,
walking past the people's restroom or outhouse, depending on how you look at it. It looks like a new cluster of tents on the upside of it. Counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 tents. A lot of larger enclosures with tents. The kitchen.
Christian structure is still around.
Hello, how you doing?
All right. Distributing sleeping bags, or?
Do I need any sleeping bags?
No, I was just wondering if you were distributing them.
Oh, no, no, I'm not.
Local?
No.
I'm so dumb.
People's Park, and I'm talking with
Porkchop.
And Porkchop, you're about to retreat to your lair.
Yeah, because, like, we get to have tents in the park. That's some shit. We never get used to do that.
Yeah, that was a couple years ago. When
man, we used to get messed with for having just a couple of blankets and more than one backpack.
How long you been a parkster?
Since I was a kid, but without, like, my mom bringing me, probably 04. That's how long I've been here.
Was your mom also a resident of the park for a while?
The deadhead. We were here when we were here, you know?
Right. How has it changed since 04, other than, of course, obviously now we have tents, for one thing?
Right. Well, when I first started hanging out here, it was all cuddies. Bushes, completely unkept. Like people would dig holes in the bushes and make camps and stuff. Like, there was, like, way more crime. Less hippies. There's way less hippies than there was for a while, but still, it's whatever.
How long have you been here since? I mean, you've been here for a long time, but continuously, how long?
Oh, this time. Well, not this time, but the time before I was here. They housed me up. I was here for 2 years, almost three. But then, long, stupid story I don't want to talk about. But I'm back out here, and I just got to figure it out. No big deal.
How long this time?
Since he... No.
Here comes the wind, which will destroy the recording. So, you say there's less crime than in years before. What do you attribute this to?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. Maybe just probably the cops being more harder on us. I don't know. They used to be they didn't give a hell about this park. You know?
Is there a lot of police presence here?
There used to be way more. Now you'll be lucky if you see the police, the bike cops, like maybe twice a day tops. They raid the bathroom for the wing nuts and then they leave. Or if they're called for something. But other than that.
Community support. Do you get much support from folks who are in the community?
From what I understand, Nick gets a lot of support from the college kids who support the protests going on here. But other than that, I support myself. I get a squirrel check and just thank the goddess for that. Or I'd probably have to do stupid shit, you know?
How's the theft problem?
Oh, ridiculous. You know, but we're in California. Meth is a thing. You know? What's that?
Does anyone have a dollar spirit?
Not that cool at all, actually. I know, right?
Wait, do you know what I said?
Yeah, a dollar spirit. A dollar for a spirit, right? Yeah.
And you said that's not that cool.
I'm not that cool, is what I said. I wish I was that cool.
It's expensive for a spirit.
Yeah, well, you know, we all got our hustles. And honestly, they're like $12 a pack now.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
How many in a pack? 20?
Oh, yeah, 20. So, like, at a dollar a piece, you're lucky if you get enough. Almost enough.
Because you're a smoker yourself.
Oh, yeah.
I was trying to catch some spirits.
So he wasn't wrong.
Being homeless here is kind of bougie. We get fed real good. You know what I mean? There's lots of support, lots of things that can help you. Most of these people who choose to be homeless, it's because of mental health things. You know what I mean? Some people don't want to get housed. They don't want help from the government. They just want to live their life. And why, you know? I know a lot of people that have friends of mine that are all whacked out in the head that will never take their housing or move into their hotels or do anything like that. Old heads are real set in their ways, some of them, you know?
Much connection from you with other encampments. I know there was some by the freeway that were around.
Oh, yeah. I know everybody here. I know people down there. They had me housed up down there, but I grew up in this town, basically. I mean, basically. Since I was too young to know better and old enough not to care. That's for damn sure in this town.
What about the here-there encampment?
That's mostly like, you know, kind of the uppity hippies. And they don't really accept everybody like People's Park does. You know, they have to have a council whether or not you can put your tent over there. You know? Which is cool. I mean, they keep out the dope fiends and the dumb shit. But, like, and they have their supporters, you know. Lots of PC hippies with lots of money in this town, you know. That's what Berkeley's for, right?
How does the student community treat you?
There's a small group of them that are hella good to us. And then there's, well, most of them, they're just asses. But yeah, they just like, they either run scared from us or they get drunk and talk shit to us at night, you know. Fridays and Saturdays, they're everywhere and they're loud. Yeah, that's cool. He's just asking how things are different from when they were when I was younger. Yeah, but it's okay. It's not a big deal. I gotta go.
Hey, we've been talking with
Porkchop.
Hey, Porkchop, this should be in. So I'm in the tent of
Tria.
And Tria, we actually have been in your tent before. You were telling me it was about 6 months ago, maybe, or at least you've been here for 6 months.
Right. Yeah.
You have a nice electrical hookup, some comfortable chairs, or at least I'm sinking pretty deep into the sofa here. How's the digs been treating you?
Well, I mean, there's wonderful people. And then there's some real jerks. I think, like, everywhere, the social worker here is awesome. His name is Ari. Do you know Ari?
I know very few people here.
Okay. He's actually, this belongs to the University of California, Berkeley, this People's Park. Mm-hmm. And so we're on their property, and Ari is the case manager, outreach social worker, and he's awesome. Mm-hmm. He's awesome. And because of Ari, I'm getting an apartment.
And when do you think you will be moving in?
I thought I was going to be moving in about a week, and then I got a call from my other case manager at Bax about an hour ago, and she said that there's somebody ahead of me, and I had no idea because I was, like, really moving ahead. I know where the apartment is. I've been interviewed, and all of a sudden today, you know, I think I'm going to be, she's calling to say I'm going to move in, and she said, there's one person ahead of you for that particular apartment, and if she doesn't get it, you know, if her heart is broken, then I will get it. So
you have been told you were going to move in, and now you're not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was crushed, and she said that she's going to remain positive and pray for me, and I just, I'm crushed, but, you know, I do remain hopeful. It's not the only apartment, but it is in Berkeley, and that's nice. It's a nice apartment, so, you know, well, the future will tell, you know.
How is life here for you in the tent? Is it, what's the upside and what's the downside?
The downside is loud rap music. It's not music, it's loud rap.
Right.
Hideous, hideous, hideous words that are so destructive and negative and down. Ugh. And I had to, today somebody had it on so loud across, I'm in the middle of the park, this is on the other side of the park, it was so loud that I had to yell directly into the tent for the person to hear it, and I, you know, yelling, I asked nicely, and he actually turned it down and said that he had it up because of the screaming was bothering him, so he blasted his hideous...
What day or night, or...?
It was just today, like about 3 hours. It was about, I would say it was like 9 o'clock.
Yeah, where it's about 2:20 right now, or 2:25.
And so that lasted, and then he had it on again, but it's not on now, so that's kind of a miracle, but I... totally believe I, even though I'm homeless, I've lived in my car since 2012.
And you still have your vehicle.
Yeah, well, it's a different car, but it's a little minivan. And, you know, to be homeless at age 73 is very frightening. It's scary for my two daughters. One of them hasn't spoken to me in 5 years. And the other one... we talk a lot. We have a decent relationship, but she has no empathy, and that's a dysfunction that she has from a parental alienation, which was something her dad did so we didn't have to pay child support when she was 13 years old. So anyway, that's the sad part about being homeless and senior in the richest country in the history of humanity. And in my home state of California, it's very...
How does Berkeley specifically treat you, would you say?
You know, Berkeley's interesting because... hi, Reggie. Just a second.
Sure. Center for the...
All right, well, today, and a really nice friend of me, whose name is Jesus, by the way, and Jesus is awesome, and he hooked us directly up to the power source, because, in fact, I've written two letters about the electricity, because there's a person here who is on a power trip who hates me. I've never had a conversation with him ever, but he thinks he's in charge or something, and he, whenever I get hooked up, he literally starts screaming at me, calling me C-U-N-T and blonde B-I-T-C-H, and he just starts screaming that I'm taking, anyway, it's a communication technique that's rather successful of just yelling. Mm. I don't know if you've experienced that. People just start yelling what they want you to think.
Mm. No, I haven't, but I can believe you. It's interesting.
It's very much how, it must be a crystal meth thing, because they just start yelling, and what can you do?
So earplugs.
Well, when they're yelling about you and disconnecting your electricity and calling you a, and then lying, and it's very disturbing.
This happened to you recently?
Yeah, it happens every time I've hooked up my electricity. So it's
is he an employee of the university or something?
No, he's I don't know. He's just on a power trip, and he.
Do other people hook up without? Is screaming or...
Yeah. This is like an insane asylum. I think it's, it's a social experiment, because the university, I don't know if your people know that they have finally approved taking down people's park.
That's what I heard, yeah.
16-story student housing is going to be, breaking ground on it this summer, I think, I hear. There's some old-time... activists who are still fighting it. I think they're trying to do it on a faulty environmental impact report. And I said, hey, I will, I'm a pretty good witness. I live here. I'm a scientist. I have a lot of skills.
What kind of science are you involved in?
My regular degree is in social ecology. So that is sort of like a multidisciplinary, and UC Irvine is the only school that has it, but it interweaves, does it work? You're going to just have to wait, okay? I'm sorry. About an hour.
Okay.
It really should be working. I don't know if you're not plugging the right thing into it.
How many people would you say have power here in the park? Or what percentage of the people? How many people live in the park?
100. And that's just a wild guess. I have no idea.
How many people do you have personal contact with?
People that I know that I have interactions with, I would say 5 or 6.
And who do you think you can rely on in a crunch, if anybody?
I have a new friend who I think I could rely on her if I could get a hold of her. And does she have a phone? I don't think she has a phone.
She's a resident here?
Yeah, she's a resident here, and I just met her mother today. Her mother's my age, and they're in good, this woman is awesome. My young friend is really interesting. She said she's been in the insane asylum 70 times in her mid-40s, so, she's extremely creative and intelligent and very interesting.
How many people rely on you?
A lot. Well, they don't rely. In fact, I just said, Reggie, I'm just like everyone else here. Because people think because I have a car and I have, that they can, they always want something. But I said, nobody has ever lightened my load here. They don't say, hey, Trio, what do you need? No, it's gimme, gimme, gimme.
This next song is called Ballad of a Cluster Bomb. We'll get back to Trio in a moment. But first, this description by David Rovix runs as follows. Propaganda by omission is powerful stuff. I've heard the words cluster munitions more on National Pentagon Radio. That's what he calls PR. In the past few days, and I have in the past few decades, if they are indeed being used by the Russian army, this is, of course, completely appalling. But I keep waiting for them to mention that although it is true that they are now banned, this ban only came about in 2008. I've been involved with campaigns to ban cluster bombs since I was a child, when American cluster bombs were slaughtering the children of Vietnam. When the American version of these bombs are made up of brightly colored plastic. Children love to play with them. Then they explode, and thousands of shards of plastic pierce the bodies of the victims. They usually die, but if not, the plastic is extremely difficult to remove. They intentionally make the bombs out of plastic so that they overwhelm the hospitals in the countless in the countries being destroyed from the air by the U.S. Air Force, like Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, where cluster bombs are used extensively in all cases. Cluster bombs are designed to kill every living thing completely indiscriminately in a given area where they are dropped. Early versions of them were first used in 1943 by the Nazis in England, though most English people don't know that because of press censorship at the time. The cluster bombs that the U.S. left behind all over the countries destroyed by the world's biggest military force, the U.S., are still killing children on a regular basis when kids find the pretty plastic balls scattered in the forests of the many U.S.-invaded Asian countries today. In 2002, I recorded this song called Ballad of a Cluster Bomb in an effort to educate the public about these indiscriminate civilian-killing bombs the U.S. has used so much. There have been so many more. Mariupols, Hue, Fallujah, so many more.
Conceived among the ivory halls, and in this world I knew my role. I went to work with a single goal. I traveled the earth to far off lands, from the Asian jungles to the African sands. I flew in planes of camouflage green.
People's Park.
And that is a problem with this social experiment here, because I would say most of the people here get SSI, which is $1,000 a month. There's no rent. People bring food, you know, food not bombs. So there's free food. They get tents for free. People bring clothing. They bring sleeping bags and jackets and all, everything is free. So what I see here after being here for 6 months, and the reason why I came here was I finally got something from the poverty industrial complex, which I immersed myself in 2013. I immersed myself in the homeless population in San Diego because I go, there's billions of dollars being, you know, going to, you know, poverty.
Bureaucrats who claim they're helping homeless people.
Yeah, but what it is, and I, you know, I do speak from firsthand experience in the trenches, is there's over 13,000 service organizations in the state of California. And for the most part, once an organization, you know, they get a great idea, hey, I'm going to provide lessons to homeless people. So they get like a $500,000 grant. And by the time they pay themselves, they get their car, they get their staff, they get their
office.
Yeah, their office.
Telephone.
Yes.
Fax machine.
They're in direct competition with the host. And that's kind of human nature, I think, unless there's... And then there's a great article that I highly recommend called Invasion of the Movement Snatchers. And so that is, there's always people sitting back, you know, like just going, waiting for the passionate, enthusiastic do-gooders like myself who really do want to save the world and end poverty and pain, you know, and suffering and save animals and, you know, everyone gets a puppy. So they come in and they quickly get rid of the really, you know, the people with unshakable integrity. And then they hire people that they know they can kind of manipulate, or people that are somewhat greedy. Or
so what did you get out of the San Diego experience in 2013?
Ooh, I know who, what, when, where, why, and how.
Have you written much about it?
No, basically, it's really hard to get help if you are critiquing the system. And there's a lot of fear of that. And so I ended up, I actually had a job. I got a job at the racetrack in 2015, and I am a racetrack professional. I fix broken horses, and I train, and I, you know, I'm a horse person. That's my
but you have no horse here.
Not now, I don't. I've had probably 100 horses in my life, so I have a whole wonderful story, and that's what I'm literally trying to do, is to recreate what I call a care farm, which uses animals, agriculture, art, and farming, animals.
I should put you in touch with our goat guy in Santa Cruz, who's part of the San Lorenzo camp in Campin, which is a large encampment in Santa Cruz, bigger than People's Park, even although not as big as San Jose's, which is immense. It's near the airport in San Jose. He has goats. And he sort of wants to he wants to work with folks in different projects involving them. And I don't know. I mean, I know nothing about animals or animal use other than eating them. That's my general approach. You know?
Don't eat your friends. But
right,
no, that's there's a guy I want to. I'm going to Google him so you can see, and we might turn this guy onto that. But he actually went from goats to sheep and became homeless like 12 or 13 years ago. And he, with his goats, but he transitioned into sheep because he likes the flavor of the milk better, and they're easier, and there's more byproducts like wool and stuff like that. But he literally has like a little covered wagon, and his ram pulls, the male sheep pulls the wagon, and the female sheep, he milks them and they have babies, and he sells cheese. And he was near Ashland, Oregon, and Ashland actually made a law that you cannot have sheep or something because he was threatening the, you know,
the local business.
Yeah, somebody didn't like him, right. So they. But anyway,
What I'm going to do is if you got a number or an email or both, I'll give it to him, and you can.
Yeah, because I'm kind of.
We're still talking with
Tria.
And Tria, what do the people here in the park make of, if anything, the escalation to war in Ukraine that's going on? Or do they make anything of it?
No, I don't think most of them even care. They're more interested in crystal meth. I don't eat anymore.
You're munching away in some pumpkin seed crunch here.
Really good. No, people are not really, they don't care about politics. I mean, and I'm just generalizing. because people are, to me, they just seem like they're into dopamine, you know, pressing the dopamine button. And the thing that they like to do is, I hate to tell you, but they watch pornography, smoke crystal meth, and listen to rap music. And everything's provided. There's no gratitude. People come here with clothing and sleeping bags and tarps and, you know, like these different groups. And it's, you know, everybody run, goes and grabs what they want. And it's really, you know, it's kind of sad because there doesn't seem to be any growth of, you know, no intention of what am I doing with my life, you know, where do I want to be in 5 years. And that could be, I don't know. Because I've really tried hard to get people interested in my model, you know, which is to solve the problems. It really does. And I believe that I'm living proof that care farming does work. So even though I haven't had a farm since January 24th, 2012, I am still, but I do study nutrition, and I try to eat healthy, organic, balanced. You know, I follow different protocols. Sometimes I eat a little bit of meat. But anyway, I stay, you know, educate myself on different things. So being 73, severely battered, PTSD, you know, I'm just a brain damage.
Kind of pretty coherent for a brain damaged person.
Yeah, but it is, which has prevented me from... You know, I think that there's that element of, you know, I've never been helped. You know, and I fought the VA for, from in writing since 2001. And I was married to a combat veteran who, as it turns out, has brain damage and PTSD and had 6 back surgeries. So I was his caregiver for 15 years, and I never got paid a dime. And because he was too messed up to navigate the VA system, I navigated it for him. And he ended up, through my labor, getting 100% service disability, and I got some benefits from that. Some wonderful benefits. My daughter was able to go to college on the VA 100%, so we did get some benefits, but I never got paid. And this guy, as it turns out, was kicked out of the Marine Corps for financial unsuitability. And
what does that mean?
It means he can't handle money. And what I will eventually... You know, I mean, I will be writing about how the V... And things have changed because I am so outspoken to the powers that be at the VA in Southern California. How should I put it? I believe that... I mean, I don't even know. I mean, they never helped me. And then when I got all the records of that, my veteran husband, through the Freedom of Information Act, I found out when he was rated in 2004, 100% service disabled, his psychiatrist, in a 5-page report, because I was there helping to validate his insanity and violence and everything. And in the report, it says... I'm quoting the psychiatrist, says, I have never in my career seen anyone so filled with rage, looking like he's going to choke his wife to death right in front of me. He is incompetent to handle his affairs, and I wouldn't dare send anyone to their ranch for fear of them being harmed. So this is the report that paralyzed veterans got. This is the report that his psychiatrist got, who still is psychiatrist from then through now, that I begged for help from.
And what's your analysis of that evaluation? Is that accurate?
Yes, absolutely accurate. So how come nobody helped me? That is the problem.
Well, so people don't see older women. You know that, of course. You're now...
Right. I mean, they used to burn us at the stake, but...
Now they don't even bother.
Yeah, no, they just let us starve to death. But, you know, that is like... So I did file an administrative claim. But then what this veteran did through his new girlfriend was to send a divorce to a fake address. So I didn't even. So he actually divorced me when he got a big increase in when he finally got paid for aid and attendance. So this whole time I was trying to get paid $2,000 a month for taking care of him, which is what I did. I took care of him through six back surgeries.
He cheated you out of your payments.
Right, but it goes to him, but since he was kicked out of the military for financial unsuitability and he was declared incompetent in 2004, and I begged for help and told them this, they literally had a legal duty to either, you know, pay me or have a fiduciary or something.
Did they?
No, they gave it directly to him, so our life was a nightmare. And I did have a lot of compassion for him because he did go to war, blah, 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 blah. And I have no compassion for him anymore, but I do hate war. War starts at home. And I believe that the VA is damage control for the military-industrial complex, and war is about profit. And if the military-industrial complex had to pay the actual collateral damage of war, war would go away. If they weren't making a profit, they would figure out another way. You know, they're just squeezing every dime out of us that they can, because they can.
I'm going to have you sum up, and then I'm going to stagger away because
okay. I can put anyone to sleep. They call me Ambien.
It's not that you're putting me to sleep, or maybe I'm just falling asleep anyway. I mean, I'm.
That's okay.
I've got a lot of energy today. But you've left me your phone number, and I will probably call you to get some updates. I guess I'm my real interest is in the community here, if there is anything, if there is a community.
And I have to lay the foundation for my own ability to express, because I think that, you know, whatever I do about my experience here, I believe God put me here because I am a jungle fighter in the trenches. There's nobody who has my background and my love of kindness, the golden rule.
Well, you did jump up to try to help Reggie the moment he came by.
Yeah. And Reggie's my...
And it's not that he's your best bosom buddy, but that he looks like you feel a responsibility to people around you.
Yeah, no, I do help Reggie. And, you know, so the people that are Reggie's an ally, David is an ally, there's a few more, but there's nobody here that would really stand up for me, I don't think, except David. There goes that music. So anyway, this is a social experiment. Ari is awesome. He's the social worker. But for the most part, these people, you know, they don't literally... And I'm going to tell you a story. I have somebody that I actually really like here, you know, as a human being, or as, you know, as somebody that I can actually talk to, but everybody's into their own reality. So we were going to go to the swap meet, the big swap meet, and he was all excited about going, but we stopped at the farmer's market first, and he goes, see that alcove over there in the police building or something, the courthouse, whatever that is? He goes, I lived in that alcove 3 years ago. I was homeless. And he goes, look at how far I've come in 3 years. And so he now has a tent at People's Park, and he told me that he masturbates 3 times a day. He plays video games, smokes crystal meth, and listens to loud music, and wants to tell me how to live my life. And when I say, you know what, let's change the subject, this is my day off, he literally gets angry and gets out of my car, and he goes, this is why nobody likes you at People's Park, is because he literally wanted to tell me how to live my life. And so these people, for some reason, I don't know if it's the meth, which is, it's really nasty shit what they're smoking here, because everybody cooks it up themselves, and it's not...
Not very pure.
I don't know what it is, but it is, you know, you're taking your life in your hand smoking it, so...
I'm going to have to cut this off. I'm going to do this.
Okay.
But if you need to reach me by phone, you can give me a call.
I've got I have your number in my phone. So anyway, so these people, whatever it is they... And another guy that I met that has a one-bedroom apartment, and he's from this, you know, he's been housed through BACS, Bay Area Community Service, he literally believes that he should be the president of the United States because he thinks he can do a good job. And he is...
much better him probably than Bill or whatever is that.
Yeah,
so, Joe Biden. Let me thank you and get out while I still can.
Yes, yes. So anytime. I love, you know, I think that...
I always like to end on a positive note, so here is a rousing, uplifting song which is guaranteed to cheer you up. When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a tedium when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are. We will all burn together when we burn. There'll be no need to stand and wait your turn. When it's time for the fallout and St. Peter calls us all out, we'll just drop our agendas and adjourn. We will all go together when we go. Every Hottentot and every Eskimo. When the air becomes Uranus, we will all go simultaneous. Yes, we all will go together when we all go together. Yes, we all will go together when we go.
That, of course, was Tom Lehrer. We will all go together when we go. A song from the 60s, but again, it becomes quite appropriate these days. What with the world on the edge of nuclear holocaust because of the Ukraine situation, with Zelensky calling for a no-fly zone and NATO okaying Polish jets to go to Ukraine. Although I guess if not vetoed by the U.S., it was strongly disapproved, and the U.S. said it would not replace Polish jets that were shot down. Here's an article that I thought kind of lays out some of the context that I think is important and I largely believe is factual, although I'm no expert on the subject. It's from antiwar.com, which is a libertarian, sometimes lefty, but also definitely libertarian website. How the U.S. has empowered and armed neo-Nazis in Ukraine by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies. And this, of course, goes to the counterclaims by the U.S. and the West and Russia regarding the extent of Nazification, if you will, of the Ukrainian government. Here's what Medea Benjamin, who's a well-known U.S. peace activist, has to say. as well as Nicholas J.S. Davies, who she writes this article with. Russian President Putin has claimed that he ordered the invasion of Ukraine to denazify its government, while Western officials, such as former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow Michael McFaul, have called this pure propaganda, insisting there are no Nazis in Ukraine. In the context of the Russian invasion, the post-2014 Ukrainian government's problematic relations with extreme right-wing groups and neo-Nazi parties has become an incendiary element on both sides of the propaganda war, with Russia exaggerating it as a pretext for war and the West trying to sweep it under the carpet. The reality behind the propaganda is that the West and its Ukrainian allies have opportunistically exploited and empowered the extreme right in Ukraine, first to pull off the 2014 coup, and then by redirecting it to fight separatists in eastern Ukraine. And far from denazifying Ukraine, the Russian invasion is likely to further empower Ukrainian and international neo-Nazis as it attracts fighters from around the world and provides them with weapons, military training, and the combat experience that many of them are hungry for. Ukraine's neo-Nazi Svoboda Party and its founders Ola Tyambak and Andrei Parubia played leading roles in the U.S.-backed coup in February 2014. Assistant Secretary Nuland and Ambassador Pyat mentioned Tyambak as one of the leaders they're working with on their infamous leaked phone call before the coup, even as they tried to exclude him from an official position in the post-coup government. Formerly peaceful protests in Kiev gave way to pitched battles with police and violent armed marches to try to break through police barricades and reach the parliament building in 2014. Svoboda members and the newly formed right sector militia, led by Dmitriy Yarosh, battled police, spearheaded marches, and raided a police armory for weapons. By mid-February 2014, these men with guns were the de facto leaders of the Maidan movement. We will never know what kind of peaceful transition or political transition peaceful protests alone would have led to in Ukraine, or how different the new government would have been if a peaceful political process had been allowed to take its course without interference by the United States or violent right-wing extremists. But it was Yarosh who took to the stage in the Maidan and rejected the February 21, 2014 agreement negotiated by the French, German, and Polish foreign ministers, under which Yukanovich, who was the premier at the time, and opposition political leaders, either the premier or the president, agreed to hold new elections later that year. Instead, Yarosh and right sector refused to disarm and led the climactic march on parliament that overthrew the government. Since 1991, Ukrainian elections had swung back and forth between leaders like President Viktor Yanukovych, who was from Donetsk, it's in the near the Russian part of the Ukraine, and had close ties with Russia, and Western-backed leaders like President Yushchenko, who was elected in 2005 after the Orange Revolution that followed a disputed election. Ukraine's endemic corruption tainted every government, and rapid public disillusionment with whatever leader and party won power led to a seesaw between Western and Russian-aligned factions. In 2014, Nuland and the State Department got their favorite, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, installed as prime minister of the post-coup government. He lasted 2 years until he too lost his job due to endless corruption scandals. Petro Poroshenko, the post-coup president, lasted a bit longer until 2019, even after his personal tax evasion schemes were exposed in the 2016 Panama Papers and the 2017 Paradise Papers. When Yatsenyuk became prime minister, he rewarded Svoboda's role in the coup, that's the neo-Nazi party, with three cabinet positions, including Oleksandr Sik as deputy prime minister and governorships of three of Ukraine's 25 provinces. Svoboda's Andrei Parubiy, another extreme right fellow, was appointed chairman or speaker of parliament, a post he held for the next 5 years. Reichenbach ran for president in 2014, but only got 1.2% of the votes and was not reelected to parliament. Ukrainian voters turned their backs on the extreme right in the 2014 post-coup elections, replacing Svoboda's 10.4% share of the national vote in 2012 to only 4.7%. Svoboda lost support in the areas where it held control of local governments, but it failed to live up to its promises, and its support was split now that it was no longer the only party running on explicitly anti-Russian slogans and rhetoric. After the coup, right sector helped to consolidate the new order by attacking and breaking up anti-coup protests in what their leader, Yarosh, described to Newsweek as a, quote, war to, quote, cleanse the country of pro-Russian protesters. This campaign climaxed on May 2nd with the massacre of 42 anti-coup protesters in a fiery inferno after they took shelter from right sector attackers in the trades union house in Odessa. In other words, they were burned up by it was set in fire, on fire by the rightists. After anti-coup protests evolved into declarations of independence in Donetsk and Luhansk, those are the two groups, the two provinces that broke away and declared themselves independent republics, the extreme right in Ukraine shifted gear to full-scale armed combat. The Ukrainian military had little enthusiasm for fighting its own people, so the government formed new National Guard units to do so. Right sector formed a battalion, and neo-Nazis also dominated the Azov Battalion, which was founded by Andrei Beletsky, an avowed white supremacist who claimed that Ukraine's national purpose was to rid the country of Jews and other inferior races. It was the Azov Battalion that led the post-coup government's assault on the self-declared republics, that's Donetsk and Luhansk, the ones that Russia claimed they were invading to protect, and retook the city of Mariupol from separatist forces. The Minsk II agreement in 2015 ended the worst fighting and set up a buffer zone around the breakaway republics, Donetsk and Luhansk, but a low-intensity civil war continued. An estimated 14,000 people have been killed since 2014. Congressman Ro Khanna and progressive members of Congress tried for several years to end U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion. They finally did so in the fiscal year 2018 defense appropriation bill, but Azov continued to receive U.S. arms and training despite the ban. In 2019, the Sufan Center, which tracks terrorist and extremist groups around the world, warned, quote, "The Azov Battalion is emerging as a critical node in the transnational right-wing violent extremist network. Its aggressive approach to networking serves one of the Azov Battalion's overarching objectives to transform areas under its control in Ukraine into the primary hub for transnational white supremacy." The Sufan Center described how the Azov Battalion's aggressive networking reaches around the world to recruit fighters and spread its white supremacist ideology. Foreign fighters who train and fight with the Azov Battalion then return to their own countries to apply what they have learned and recruit others. Violent foreign extremists with links to Azov have included Brenton Tarrant, who massacred 51 worshippers at a mosque in Christchurch in New Zealand in 2019, and several members of the U.S. Rise Above movement who were prosecuted for attacking counter-protesters at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in August 2017. Other Azov veterans have returned to Australia, Brazil, Germany, Italy, Norway, Sweden, the U.K., and other countries. Despite Svoboda's declining success in national elections, Svoboda is the right-wing party in Ukraine, neo-Nazi and extreme nationalist groups increasingly linked to the Azov Battalion have maintained power on the street in Ukraine and in local politics in the Ukrainian nationalist heartland around Lvov in western Ukraine. After President Zelensky's election in 2019, he's the current president, the extreme right threatened him with removal from office or even death if he negotiated with separatist leaders from the Donbas, that's the two republics that broke away, and followed through on the Minsk protocol of maintaining the ceasefire and holding elections. Zelensky had run for election as a peace candidate, but under threat from the right, he refused to even talk to Donbass leaders, whom he dismissed as terrorists. During Trump's presidency, the United States reversed Obama's ban on weapons sales to Ukraine, and Zelensky's aggressive rhetoric raised new fears in Donbass and Russia that he was building up Ukraine's forces for a new offensive to retake Donetsk and Luhansk by force. The civil war has combined with the government's neoliberal economic policies to create fertile ground for the extreme right. The post-coup government imposed more of the same neoliberal shock therapy that was imposed throughout Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Ukraine received a $40 billion IMF bailout and, as part of the deal, privatized 342 state-owned enterprises, reduced public sector employment by 20%, along with salary and pension cuts, privatized health care, disinvested in public education, closing 60% of its universities. Coupled with Ukraine's endless corruption, these policies led to profitable looting of state assets by the corrupt ruling class and to falling living standards and austerity measures for everybody else. The post-coup government upheld Poland as its model, but the reality was closer to Yeltsin's Russia in the 1990s. After a nearly 25% fall in GNP, gross domestic product, between 2012 and 2016, Ukraine is still the poorest country in Europe. As elsewhere, the failures of neoliberalism have fueled the rise of right-wing extremism and racism, and now the war with Russia promises to provide thousands of alienated young men from around the world with military training and combat experience, which they can then take home to terrorize their own countries. The Sufan Center has compared the Azov Battalion's international networking strategy as similar to that of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. U.S. and NATO support for the Azov Battalion poses similar risks as their support for Al-Qaeda-linked groups in Syria 10 years ago. Those chickens quickly came home to roost when they spawned ISIS and turned decisively against their Western backers in Syria. Right now, Ukrainians are united in their resistance to Russia's invasion, but we should not be surprised when the U.S. alliance with neo-Nazi proxy forces in Ukraine, including the infusion of billions of dollars in sophisticated weapons, results in a similarly violent and destructive blowback. In other words, more civil war inside Ukraine. And that's an article by Medea Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davies on the antiwar.com website, How U.S. Has Empowered and Armed Neo-Nazis in the Ukraine. Here's an article from Counterpunch called Calling for More War is Not a Desire for a Just Peace, by Ron Jacobs. Let me begin by stating that I am not a patriot. I'm not a patriot of the United States, Ukraine, Russia, China, Mexico, or any other nation in the world. Let me continue by saying that if I were a Ukrainian in Ukraine right now, I would be resisting the invading troops. The same could be said if I were a Palestinian in Gaza or the occupied territories. If troops and tanks were in the streets of a city in the United States, I would be resisting them. Of course, the only troops and tanks I've seen in the U.S. cities had U.S. flags on them. I would be resisting because they were threatening the existence of my community, my family, and my friends. I would not be resisting them because I am a patriotic American. Furthermore, I would refuse to wear any uniform identifying me as such. Likewise, if I were a Ukrainian resident, I would reject any uniform. Fighting and killing in the name of someone else's idea of community, that is, the nation state, makes one a pawn in their plans for power and dominance. Yet humans do so all the time. When this war is over, the only certainty is that things will be worse off for those who are doing the most of the fighting. In other words, it is understandable the Ukrainians are fighting the invading army. Their lives, homes, fields, and communities are threatened. What makes much less sense is the virulent desire of millions of citizens in other nations to inflame the situation in Ukraine. Sanctions, call for a no-fly zone, talking about sending fighter planes from NATO countries to Ukraine, joining Ukrainian forces, many led by neo-Nazis, to fight. All the energy going into supporting and partaking in these bellicose actions are ramping up the dogs of war and making the world even more dangerous than it already is. Pretending otherwise is just a lie. I'm here to call for something else, something that may not be as emotionally satisfying for those who want to punish someone, something that requires thinking beyond the propaganda we've all been fed since we were born, something that acknowledges the culpability of the rulers in Washington and other capitals of the global north in provoking and now sustaining the senseless war in Ukraine. Furthermore, it is something that is more likely to bring about a reasonably just solution to the situation in Ukraine than continuing this bloody war. What I'm calling for are an immediate and unconditional ceasefire and multilateral peace talks. If these two things can be established, the killing would diminish considerably. Furthermore, it would pave the way for a withdrawal of Russian forces from Ukraine, an end to sanctions, and an end to NATO expansion, which are already the demands of anti-war coalitions in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. Calling for this, I am joining many others around the globe, from governments and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to individual citizens and groups opposed to war. The way I see it is that if the war continues, the outcomes that are most likely include either a defeat for Ukraine or a much wider war involving NATO. Neither of these outcomes would bode well for the future of Ukraine or the world. Indeed, they both hold a potential too horrible to consider. It is clear to me that this war is occurring because Washington, NATO, Moscow, and certain sectors in Ukraine put their interests above those of most Ukrainians. The current Ukrainian government's refusal to declare neutrality is from the NATO-Washington playbook. Indeed, instead of the clear sovereignty Ukrainian neutrality would declare to the world, Kiev's insistence on wanting to join NATO suggests a subservience to Western interests which treat Ukraine as a game board. Moscow's invasion comes from similar intentions in Russia. Like ruling elites around the world, Ukrainian officials in government and commerce are primarily interested in what benefits them, money and power. The current rulers apparently believe Washington and NATO will help them maintain and expand both by adopting a Ukrainian patriotism magnified by a rabid right-wing nationalist element in the government, military, and general population. The rulers of Ukraine have brought the nation to a place that may destroy the Ukrainian national dream for another generation, or it might bring about something much, much worse. And that's Ron Jacobs, who's written the book called The Daydream Sunset, 60s Counterculture in the 70s, and the article is called Calling for War is not a desire for a just peace. And that's from the Counterpunch website. And that's it for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside. Let's go out on another one of those Tom Lehrer songs that is old, but sadly still with us in relevance.
So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. But while you swelter down there in your shelter, you can watch me on your TV. While we're attacking frontally, watch brinkily and huntily, describing contrapuntally the cities we have lost. No need for you to miss a minute of the agonizing Holocaust. Yeah! Little Johnny Jones, he was a U.S. pilot, and no shrinking violet was he. He was mighty proud when World War III was declared. He wasn't scared, no siree. And this is what he said on his way to Armageddon. So long, Mom, I'm off to drop the bomb, so don't wait up for me. Back to my home, although it may be a pile of debris. Remember, Mommy, I'm off to get a commie, so send me a salami and try to smile somehow. I'll look for you when the war is over, an hour and a half from now. Thank you.
try to read what I'm supposed to read. Not sound condescending, predictable, or mean. I could run out the door, I'm not thinking about it anymore. A toast and drink to things to ignore. Just ruminate, 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 ruminate.
California, a university and beach town, one of America's most liberal cities, now has the toughest panhandling ordinance in California.